Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hello, everybody. Chuck Bonnell, Julie Hayden here in a beautiful July day. Chuck and Julie Show, True Straight Up, brought to you by
Colorado Cenogenics with Dr. Julie McCallan, and also America's CitizenPress.com, a great conservative site. Today, we've got a great show coming up. We're going to have Stephen Meyer on. We've had him on before. He's a biologist, and he's got a great book out, The Return of the God Hypothesis. And in light of some of the attacks that we're seeing on Christianity right now, there are some leftists out there saying that the Bible is racist. That means God is racist. So, of course, we can't, you know, teach anything that might even remotely have to do with religious because it's racist.
We must go with just logical things as critical race theory and other wonderful.
Another kind of other stuff that's how that goes. Exactly. And then, you may have noticed that crime is skyrocketing.
Yeah.
In Denver, I think over the 4th of July weekend, there were like in a Sunday space of 3 hours, like 5 shootings. In Denver, the crime rate is up like 22%. And what's really interesting about this is it's not just homicides that are up. It's a lot of property crimes, bike thefts, out of control in Denver, apparently. Did you see? I mean, you've all seen that video of the people just robbing the San Francisco store and running away, right? And they're not even doing anything
to stop.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the mayor of New York City, the newest mayor of New York City, Mr. Adams, ran on a basis that crime is the most important issue, and apparently is one.
It's working, exactly. So we'll be talking to Weld County Sheriff Steve Reams about that to get, as I've been saying, his take on the truth straight up on that situation. But right now, I see we have Stephen Meyer on the phone. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. We loved having you on last time and have really been looking forward to this. So good afternoon.
That was one of our best half hours, and if ever there's a best of Chuck and Julie, that'll be on it. So thrilled to have you back.
Well, I'm delighted to be back. Thanks for the kind words, Chuck, and good to hear your voice too, Julie. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Two things.
Well, let's just
jump right in.
Well, no, let's talk a little bit about. Okay. About not everybody will know. Steve, I think went to Whittier College, which was Richard Nixon's alumni there, and then went on to Cambridge for his doctorate. He's a biologist and has written a couple great books. Now we have a third one. The one I enjoyed so much was Darwin's Doubt, and this newest one is Return of the God Hypothesis. And so it's getting a lot of comment and some attacks, which is always fun.
Because we're not supposed to talk about that's racist, Stephen, totally racist. I probably didn't know that God is racist now.
Well, I've had different kinds of attacks than that one, but you're right about my background. With one exception, Chuck, I went to Whitworth College in Spokane.
Oh,
The distinction of going to the same place as the former president, but it's been an exciting few months for me. The book was released in March, March 30th. We've had a lot of reaction to the book, lots of Amazon reviews, and the book, we were fortunate to get the book onto the national bestseller list for USA Today and Publishers Weekly right out of the chute. So we've been getting a lot of attention, and I think the most important thing is that the message is getting out, and we've been told for years that science properly understood undermines belief in God, and I wrote the book to show that the exact opposite is the truth.
Well, let me ask you this, and we'll get into a little bit more about the details there. But I know, when we were talking with the gal who helped us, book you, we initially were going to have you on, and then you were busy to talk about, the UFO report and kind of the irony that for whatever reason, it's okay and accepted to believe that UFOs seeded human life on Earth. But the fact or the concept that there might have been some sort of intelligent design. Mm-hmm. Because where did the UFO people come from in the first place? But I mean, that we're not supposed to talk about, right?
Well, exactly. And the reason that the alien designer hypothesis has been proposed by a number of scientists is that the cell, the simplest unit of life, has turned out to be not so simple at all. That inside even the simplest living cells on Earth, we find complex information storage, transmission, and processing system, and all of which is run by the digital code stored in the DNA. And so we're all used to talking about the DNA molecule, and we know about DNA being used in criminal forensics, and we get our ancestry checked by looking at our DNA, but we kind of overlook the most important thing about DNA, which is that it encodes or stores instructions in a digital form, a four-character digital code that directs the construction of the crucial machinery in the cell made of proteins that keep us all alive. And this was the big discovery of Watson and Crick in the 1950s. And then Crick proposed what he called the sequence hypothesis a bit later, in which he hypothesized that inside the DNA molecule, the chemical subunits, they're called bases, are functioning just like alphabetic characters in a written text or like the zeros and ones in a section of software. And we now know that Crick was entirely right about that. Bill Gates, the software developer here in our area, says DNA is like a software program, but much more complex than any we've ever created. We know from experience that software always comes from programmers, and we know more generally that whenever we find information in a digital or alphabetic form and we trace that information back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, whether we're talking about software or a paragraph in a book or hieroglyphic inscriptions or information embedded in a radio signal. Information is the product of mind. So the discovery of information at the foundation of life points decisively, I've argued, towards the activity of a designing mind in the origin and history of life.
Did you read the critique of your book by Daryl Falk and Biologus?
I did indeed, and we had a great deal of fun responding to that in some significant detail. Just for your listeners who.
Go ahead. Go ahead and explain that. Yeah.
Well, right. So Daryl, there's a group called Biologos who are committed to what's called theistic evolution. My view is that they put great emphasis on the evolution and very little emphasis on the theism, because they don't really say what God did in the evolutionary process other than exist. But in any case, Falk has been critical of my work on intelligent design, and he wrote a review of the book saying, well, Meyer argues that one particular type of origin of life simulation experiment called an RNA world simulation experiment. And the background on that is that some scientists have proposed that life might have begun with an RNA molecule that can copy itself. RNA is like DNA. It's used in the process of information transfer inside the cell. So the information in present cell starts in DNA, is copied onto an RNA molecule, which then is used to direct the construction of the proteins at an assembly site called a ribosome. Okay. In any case, the idea is that RNA might have been the original molecule, and that it has some capacity to catalyze reactions like proteins do, and it has some capacity to store information like DNA does. So maybe it was the whole show at the beginning, and there was an RNA molecule that could copy itself. I point out in the book that even with the help of very smart scientists intelligently designing RNA molecules, they've only been able to get an RNA molecule that can copy about 10% of itself. Falk, in his review, said, no, that's not true. There are these experiments run by a scientist named Gerald Joyce that have been published since Meyer, since the paper that Meyer cited, and Meyer's unaware of this. And these experiments show that pretty much the whole RNA molecule can copy itself. Right. Well, we showed in a reply, it was written by my colleague, Brian Miller, but I also addressed this very experiment in my book. Somehow Falk missed it. and we showed that these RNA world experiments involve extensive intelligent design by the investigator, and they don't actually involve the full copying of the molecule. There's a molecule that they design, an RNA molecule full of information. Then they design two complementary molecules to match up with it, with a gap in between, And all their experiment shows is that the gap can be, that one connection can be made. Well, that's not what's involved in replication. Replication requires having to copy the whole of a molecule letter by letter. And this is just making one linkage. Moreover, they also use protein enzymes that they derive from already existing cells to help with this copying process. And that's really kind of fishy because, or it's a bit of a cheat because they're trying to demonstrate how you could get life from non-living chemicals. And what they're doing in order to show that you could get a self-replicating RNA system, they take protein enzymes from living bacteria to help with the copying process, which is totally contrary to what they're trying to demonstrate. We provided a very thorough critique of Falk's critique of my book, and also showed that I already made those critiques of the experiments in the book. I was not unaware of them, and the book did address them in some considerable detail. So
yeah, the basic thrust of his one was that you were kind of a biologist 20 years behind in what's happened for the last 20 years.
Exactly. Saying, but in fact, the problem is that they made no progress, no genuine progress on demonstrating how RNA might have been the first self-replicating system in 20 years' time.
Right. And I'm going to get a little political here and see what you think. Why? Because I noticed earlier today you had retweeted an article in The Federalist where they were talking about, you know, that the left agenda wants essentially to, you know, you have to totally believe in evolution. You can't believe in any kind of intelligent design because that's racist, because the Bible is racist, and because, you know, Adam and Eve were white. And while they got that, I mean, the person in the column kind of points out that's ridiculous in and of itself. But why is it, do you think, that they keep bending over backwards to avoid acknowledging that maybe there was intelligent design? I mean, it's pretty soon you're going to be, I mean, I'm halfway joking here, called racist for suggesting it, because clearly they're trying to go down God is racist because he made Adam and Eve white, even though they don't believe in Adam and Eve. So I don't. But why is it that they seem so determined to stamp out any and all questioning or at least the remotest thought that there was, again, intelligent design?
Here's the even more basic question, I think, is that there's any problems with neo-Darwinism. That's what drives me crazy. I mean, it kind of saying, oh, no, it's perfect. It explains everything. It does everything. You don't have to worry about anything. No, don't
question.
Don't worry your little mind about that. It's the science is settled.
Follow
the science, and it's settled, and there are no questions. In neo-Darwinism today, I mean,
as you're well aware, Chuck, factually false. Leading evolutionary biologists are now calling for a new theory of evolution. Because they recognize that the mutation natural selection mechanism has very little creative power. It does a nice job of explaining small-scale variations, finch beaks getting a little bigger, a little smaller, moths turning dark and light and dark again. But it does a very poor job. It's completely inadequate as an explanation for the major, what are called innovations in form, the major morphological innovations in the history of life, such as are documented in the fossil record. And as you know, I wrote a whole book about one of those major innovations where the first animals come into the fossil record. That was my book, Darwin's Doubt. But I attended a conference at the Royal Society in 2016, which was convened by a group of evolutionary biologists. It was held in London, and they called it because they were looking for a new theory of evolution or new evolutionary mechanisms that could compensate for the lack of creative power associated with the main evolutionary mechanism of Darwinian natural selection acting on random mutations. And so as a factual matter, neo-Darwinism is in serious trouble as a scientific theory of biological origins, even within the field of evolutionary biology. But to address Julie's question, I have a friendly debating partner that I've done a number of debates with over the years or conversations, Michael Ruse. He's a good guy, British professor who's come to the United States, and he's been at Florida State, and he wrote an important book pointing out that neo-Darwinism has functioned as a kind of secular religion for many scientists because it answers the question of origins that every worldview has to answer. Every worldview addresses the question of what is the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else came. Neo-Darwinism provides a necessary element in a materialistic or naturalistic account of origins. It says that simpler one-celled organisms evolved by Darwinian processes to become all the different forms of life we see today, and those one-celled organisms in turn evolved from simpler chemical non-living chemicals, and those chemicals developed from simpler atoms that were in elementary particles that were around from eternity past. That's sort of the naturalistic creation story. In other words, there was no ultimate creation. Matter and energy are self-existent. And so Darwinism is a big part of that story,
right,
and therefore a big part of what has functioned as a kind of secular religion, an alternative worldview to classical theism. So when scientific challenges are raised in neo-Darwinism, many scientists instinctively perceive that it's not just a scientific theory that's being challenged, but a deeply held worldview. And they react in a very human way, like anyone does when their deeply held beliefs are being challenged, often somewhat aggressively or with some spit and vinegar, you know. So I think, and there's been a tremendous attempt to suppress dissent around those people who would question neo-Darwinism, or conversely advocate that there is evidence of actual design in nature, not just the appearance of design, which Darwinists acknowledge. Richard Dawkins has famously said that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. But for the Darwinist or the neo-Darwinist, that appearance is an illusion. We want to say, well, wait a minute, not so fast. Right. Some of these appearances of design have not been explained by natural selection and random mutation or any other evolutionary mechanism. Instead, they bear all the hallmarks of actual design, including especially the digital code and the information processing system that we find inside cells.
Well, you indicated that you found a good debating partner, and that's always difficult to do. I have a rule of thumb that if I find somebody I find highly intelligent and is agnostic, or usually more an atheist, to determine whether I can have an intelligent debate without I'm just going into kind of the vice president's cackles or something else, you ask him, do you believe Moses was a real person? Now, Moses may or may not have existed 1,200 years ago. He may or may not have led the Israelites out of Egypt. And there's no video or real evidence, but you wouldn't expect anybody to pull up on an Egyptian stele that some slaves left and are wandering around the desert. I mean, it's just unknowable. But if they're confirmed atheists, they will tell you Moses did not exist. He did not exist. He could not have existed. They would have noted his, and just kind of go, well, you know, people think that Detroit exists. People didn't think, and then it did. The Xi Dynasty, first dynasty, was considered a myth, and then it's not. But if you get somebody who will just adamantly tell you Moses could not have existed, then you're not going to have a very good debate, because he's not going to acknowledge anything beyond his own
belief system.
Well,
it's their religion. I mean, their non-religion is a religion.
It would be easy enough to say, well, I don't know if Moses existed or not. Maybe, maybe not. But they will adamantly tell you, because fear that the Bible may have some relevancy is just life-threatening to them, just life-threatening.
Well, it's interesting you raise that as an example. I have a very considerable side interest in the question of the historical reliability of the Bible, and in particular, the question of the Exodus. And for your listeners that are interested in that, I might refer them to the work of a young archaeologist, Titus Kennedy, who's published a book, The Bible Unearthed. And there's actually quite a lot of good evidence for an historical exodus, and some of that's covered in his new book, so people might have a look at that. But I take your broader point, which is that if you're dealing with someone who on the basis of a presupposition has dismissed the possibility of the position for which you're arguing, as opposed to dismissing it on the basis of evidence, you may not have a very productive conversation.
But I
think what's interesting in the debate about biological origins is that leading biologists on the evolutionary side have framed the key issue on terms that I think are actually quite constructive. When Dawkins says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. We want to take him on exactly that point and say, okay, is that fine? That's good observation. We're studying the appearance of design. Now the question is that appearance merely an appearance? Is it an illusion or is it real? And the idea of intelligent design was framed around that question. A lot of people have said, well, intelligent design is sort of some surreptitious attempt to smuggle biblical creationism into the public schools. It was no such thing. It was intentionally framed around the crucial issue that the evolutionary biologists, going back all the way to Darwin, have recognized as the crucial issue. And that is the question of the appearance of design. Is it real or imaginary?
Well, and it would seem to me that, you know, if you're a real scientist, it would seem to me that you would just look at it and say, either I don't know or the evidence tips one way or the other. But to me, it sort of seems similar to me anymore to the whole climate change, which global warming, they changed the terms around. But, you know, I have a friend who, she's not my friend anymore because I don't subscribe to her complete theory, you know, of global warming. And she literally says, I am killing her children with my ideas. I mean, how do you even have a conversation? And then, I mean, she doesn't want to hear the science. She doesn't want to take a look at the fact that the science has changed, et cetera, et cetera. And I am, you know, worried about this. Now they're pushing it into biology and religion. It just seems to me that the left doesn't want to have anything to do with facts or actual science. Science is going to be what they say it is. And if you disagree, like I said earlier, then you're racist, then you're wrong, then you're a denier. And they want to shut you down. I mean, you're going to be like those COVID doctors pretty soon. You know, the hydroxychloroquine doctors, you know, you're going to be banned from YouTube and everything like that. I mean, if you don't start stepping in line, Stephen, and acknowledge that, mm-hmm. that they're absolutely right.
Well, there's two conceptions of science. There's science as a source of indisputable deliverances, indisputable statements or propositions that are backed by an indubitable consensus. That conception of science leads inevitably to technocracy, not democracy, but technocracy ruled by experts.
Okay.
The other conception of science, which I think is the sound conception of science, is science as a mode of inquiry that involves competing interpretations of evidence that's gathered in some systematic way, where the scientists are trying to interpret the evidence, will often need to argue with each other about what the best interpretation or explanation of that evidence is. There's a wonderful philosopher of science from Italy, Marcello Pera, and Pera argues that science advances as scientists argue about how to interpret evidence, that there's an ineliminable rhetorical dimension to science. And so when people appeal to consensus to settle scientific disputes, it's almost a rule of thumb with me now that there isn't a consensus. Nobody's appealing to settled science or consensus to get people to believe that the formula for water is H2O or that the formula for salt is NaCl. These things really are settled science, and there really is a consensus behind them and a great deal of evidence to support the view. Currently, when people are appealing to consensus, it's usually to stifle or to suppress scientific dissent among other scientists who disagree with the alleged prevailing hypothesis or explanation. And that is actually using science in that first, I think, more less productive way, where we're going to use science as a source of authority that may or may not have evidential support behind it, and science that is actually stifling that process, that rhetorical process of argumentation, open argumentation that's necessary to scientific progress.
Well, and then they want you to believe things sometimes that just aren't even true, right?
You don't know if they're true. But the problem is scientists often do not abandon their well-held beliefs. And we talked about Fred Hoyle last time, who I looked up, and I guess he lived till 2001. And I was so impressed you got to meet him, who was a Marxist, communist, but a very bright guy, steady state theory and everything else. But he never really changed his belief the Big Bang was BS. And I guess
he never did. But interestingly about Hoyle, he started out as a strident atheist,
right.
A very committed atheist. It was one of the reasons he rejected the Big Bang theory. He thought that it right. obviously supported the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation, and he was a materialist. And right. so he labeled the evidence for the beginning of the universe, the quote unquote Big Bang, in order to ridicule it. And right. the name caught on, and it's with us still to this day. But an interesting thing about Hoyle is that he then later discovered some of the crucial fine-tuning parameters that make life possible in the universe, and realized how incredibly improbable they were, and ended up adopted a proto or quasi theistic position, and later said that a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry, and that there are no random forces to speak of in nature. And he accepted the need for some sort of intelligent designer.
Right.
And when I had a chance to speak with him I was a mere wet behind the ears PhD student at the time, but we had a long talk after a talk that he gave when he visited Cambridge. And I told him about some of my interest in the evidence of design related to the digital information and the information bearing properties of DNA. And he kind of perked up and he says, there's no question if we could consider a mind as part of the explanation, it would make a lot more sense of that that evidence we have about the origin of life. So he was someone who had changed his mind about some very important issues. And of course, that's what a good scientist should be at least willing
right.
to do that when confronted with new evidence.
Well, most people, they point out that theories are accepted when the old people die. They don't kind of get new appearance. They're just all the people who believed it, but no longer make
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, yeah. There's an old maxim from, it's probably a paraphrase of the work of Thomas Kuhn, who wrote the famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And his argument was that scientific revolutions happen essentially one funeral at a time as an older generation dies off and younger scientists confronted with a new way of thinking about things gradually
right.
adopt it.
Not
wishing any older scientists to die off, there is definitely a sense where a generational change is sometimes needed to get yes. people to think differently. And we're in fact seeing that happening in the debate about intelligent design. We're attracting a tremendous number of highly talented younger scientists who see that the intelligent design not only provides a better explanation of already known facts like the digital code in DNA, the information processing systems in cells, the nanotechnology that we find inside cells, the circuitry that's involved in animal development. I could go on. But additionally, the concept of design and the idea that life is the product of an intelligent design provides a framework for doing biology that's a bit different than the Darwinian framework. You would expect to find different things in living systems if they were the product of a designing mind rather than an undirected, unguided process that built life bottom up, as it were, from simpler molecules to complex ones, as opposed to life starting as a result of a pre-existing blueprint in the mind of a designing agent. And so one of the things that's happening in our larger network of scientists who are interested in intelligent design is that our scientists now are using design as what's called a heuristic guide, a guide to discovery. They're saying, well, if life were designed, maybe we ought to find some design patterns of the kind that we find in high-tech digital computing inside the genome. And some of our scientists are going and looking for such things, and they're finding them, and they wouldn't have been expected on a Darwinian model. For example,
right.
our scientists have been predicting that the so-called junk DNA would turn out not to be junk, but rather
right.
would be importantly functional. And indeed, that's what's been discovered. So anyway, it's an exciting time. I think we're seeing a scientific revolution happening before our very eyes around this crucial question of design in biology.
How do you come out on the eternal debate, both theologically and both scientifically, of the existence of evil and decay? I mean, if a intelligence designed to be intelligently designed, all the pain and horror and the enormous.
I have an answer for that, Chuck. We'll let the expert answer.
We can do upstairs.
You may have a better one than mine, Julie. I don't know. But I do write a long footnote about that at the end of chapter 14 in the new book, Return of the God Hypothesis. If I only held to the theory of intelligent design, I might be somewhat flummoxed by the evidence of what philosophers call natural evil, evil that isn't, or harm, natural things that happen in nature that are harmful to humans that are not the product of human choice.
Right.
And but I also happen to be a Christian and a biblical Christian, in the sense that I believe the Bible, not that I always obey it. I'm working on that part. I think that's important because some of the people who were arguing for what's called classical natural theology in the 19th century were doing something from a kind of almost Platonic worldview. And so they expected to find nothing but evidence of good design or evidence only of good design in nature. You read the end of William Paley's great work on natural theology, you get the sense that he may never have left a Cambridge or Oxford garden. He doesn't have any sense of anything having ever gone wrong in nature. But if you have a biblically informed worldview, and you can join that with the expectation of seeing intelligent design in nature with a commitment to the theory of intelligent design, you would expect to see two things in nature. You would expect to see evidence of aboriginal design, good design that's been present in nature from the beginning, but also evidence of subsequent decay. And you get an affirmation of both of those two propositions in the New Testament book of Romans, for example, where St. Paul says, from the things that are made, the unseen qualities of the Creator, his eternal power and a divine nature, sometimes translated wisdom, are clearly manifest. So nature is displaying, or as the psalmist puts it, the heavens declare the glory of God. Nature manifests the attributes of the deity. But also Romans later in that same book, St. Paul affirms that there's something about nature that's gone wrong and that nature itself is groaning for its redemption, having been subjected to decay. And that it is that there should be evidence. We should see evidence of decay in nature. And we do. So as an intelligent design theorist who also happens to be a Bible believer, I expect to see two things in nature, both of which we see: evidence of original good design, and then evidence of subsequent decay. Interestingly,
wait, Stephen, I hate to do this to you, but we've run out of time.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, we're going to have you back on, and we'll talk about this, and then we'll get my theory too.
We could have you on for years, but this is so wonderful talking with you. Enjoy every second of our conversations, and
encourage
everybody should get the book, Return of the God Hypothesis, and get Darwin's Doubt.
Stephen, and follow Stephen C. Meyer on Twitter. Stephen, thank you so much for your time. We'll get you back soon.
You bet. Thank you for having me on and for such good questions.
All right. Thank you. Switching gears now. I guess actually now we're going to talk about the evidence of decay.
Decay. Yeah, that's right.
With Weld County Sheriff Steve Reams. I want to bring him on up. Steve, hey, thank you for your time today. The reason I called you is there's been a lot of reporting lately.
Well, tell who he is.
He's Weld County Sheriff Steve Reams.
Okay. They don't
American patriot. Okay. Hero. grassroots hero. Soon to be governor, maybe someday of Colorado. Who knows? New congressional districts.
That's enough.
Steve, I just drafted you for a lot of things. But it was a good story, I thought, in Complete Colorado. And it talked about in three northern Colorado jails, there are like over 100 murder suspects awaiting trial. And it's not a situation where just the courts are backlogged and these guys have been sitting there for years. But there's been, I believe, a massive increase in violent crime, a massive increase in property crime. I mean, why don't you talk a little bit about what you're seeing? And is it one of those things where people are just playing with statistics, or is it worse out there than it was before?
So, first off, thanks for having me on. You know, this is a topic that doesn't get covered by the mainstream media because, quite frankly, it's not something I think the mainstream media wants out there in the public. But to be short, yes, we are seeing an increase in crime, and we saw a substantial increase through what I'll call the COVID year, 2019, 2020. into 2019, into 2020 was terrible for a multitude of reasons. But, you know, you don't see that getting reported because everything was focused on how we're going to, you know, deal with the virus. Well, in the meantime, we had crime running rampant in many parts of the state. I think auto theft was up almost 150% throughout the state. But crime in Weld County, Colorado, across all crime rates from 2019 to 2020 increased 32%. And the way that this story got kind of caught traction with Sherry Pife was she called to ask me a question about a specific homicide case and kind of what the path was going to be for this case through the courts. And I explained to her that the courts were shut down and pretty much law enforcement had, the judicial process had stopped in almost every county. And at that time, I had 36 inmates awaiting a homicide case or awaiting trial for a homicide case. And by the time that she ran her story, I think that number had actually jumped up to 38.
Wow.
So yeah, crime has gone crazy during COVID. But again, that's not the thing that you'll hear on the news because, you know, we want to make it sound like, or the news wants to make it sound like all these early release processes from prisons and parole was so successful. And it couldn't, that couldn't be farther from the truth. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. And one of the things, and that kind of gets up with the question, I know, I don't know if it was your jurisdiction or maybe it was even in Denver, but it was someplace. It was like out of the 18 homicide suspects, 11 of them were on some form of supervision from the judicial department, from the criminal justice system. They were on parole. They were on probation. They were out on a PR bond. I mean, to me, that's, and because that's, I've been trying to cover this and have been sounding the alarm about this for years. And there was a time when even the Denver district attorney, a Democrat, Mitch Morrissey, was complaining about it. He said the judges, his words, exact words were, he wouldn't say this anymore because it's not woke, but the judges are going to have blood on their hands in Denver because they're releasing all of these people on PR bonds, no matter what their past criminal history, even if they've committed another crime. And I think that has got to, if you're a criminal, I mean, what do the guys that you arrest say? It's like, big deal. I'm going to be out. It's like in the movies, right? I'm going to be out before you get home from your shift.
So that's exactly what we've experienced. I mean, a person who's a brazen criminal, you know, they've committed their lives to, you know, victimizing other people. They really don't care about the consequences of jail anymore because they know that if they get arrested, they go to jail, they're either going to be given a PR bond or they're going to be given a very low cash or surety bond and they're going to get out. And at the end of it all, let's say even if a judge doesn't grant them an immediate release on a bond, well, the court systems are so backed up that the district attorneys are going to be cutting plea deals with them, so they're probably going to get out in short order anyways. We had one specific individual that just during 2020, we had to arrest him 8 times before we finally got a bond that would hold him in jail. All of his stuff was property crimes, but we've tied over $500,000 in theft to he and his crew over the course of 2020. These are property thefts that you'll hear some legislators say, oh, well, you have insurance for that. Well, we all have businesses and expenses, and insurance isn't just this magical thing that covers us all. And there were real victims tied to this individual's crime sprees, and he's just one of many that we dealt with through 2020.
If all the other things don't work, you know, is become an FBI informant and rake havoc on your community with utter immunity.
It's, you know, and it, the thing is that I think the legislators, they have protection and they like to spout off these things. But if you're somebody who's, that's to say, you got to get up in the morning, you got to get your kids to daycare or to school, and then you have to go to work and you come out and your car has been vandalized, your tire slashed, your car broken into. Okay. That is like, you have insurance, but insurance, number one, doesn't deal with that problem that day. Deal with the fact
and
that
your
probably
rates go up.
Well, and your rates go up and all your neighbors' cars have been vandalized too. And it used to make me, and it still does, so angry. And they say, well, it's just a property crime. It's like, it's not just a property crime if it's your property that's being, you know, the crime is being committed upon.
Well, you know, I tell people all the time that when we have this debate, the place that you feel that you should feel the most safe is in your own home. And if someone breaks in your home and burglarizes your home, that's just a property crime. But I can tell you that the effects that that has on the homeowner, on the person who was burglarized, is far-reaching beyond just the property that was taken or the doorway that was kicked open. I mean, that's your safe space. That's where you should be able to enjoy your life. And when someone violates that or they take your vehicle, it's typically the people who can least afford to have that kind of impact who are hit the hardest.
Well, right. Do you think, in the New York mayor's race was run on key question for Mr. Adams and got elected is based on crime. Do you think that's going to factor into the governor's race? I don't see it factoring in to date. I don't see the Heidi Goodalls of the world hitting it hard or anything else.
Well, I don't know how that couldn't be an issue. You know, if anyone's running for a statewide political office right now and they can't find issues to run on, then they don't have their eyes open. Because you can go through downtown Denver, you can talk to victims of crime, you can talk to businesses that have been shut down for whatever reason. During the legislative session when Senator Pete Lee was trying to pass Senate Bill 273, the one that would basically bar you from arresting people for any low-level felony or misdemeanor, there were bolder business owners that testified against that bill because they were essentially being shut down by criminals in downtown Boulder on Pearl Street. That's enough to tell you right there that these policies don't work. Senate Bill 62, Senate Bill 273, both bills that Senator Pete Lee was trying to run, Democrats in Boulder said this doesn't work. I mean, if they're identifying it doesn't work, I don't know how Republican candidates can't come out and say, "Hey, Governor, you've got this wrong. You're not helping Colorado.
You decided to rerun for sheriff for another term rather than for some other office, either is that Julie just laid out. Why did you decide that you would not seek a different office, sir?
Well, so quite candidly, I never got into law enforcement to be in politics. I got into law enforcement because I wanted to help people, and I love the job that I do. I love the place that I'm at. Weld County is a fantastic place to live. It's a great place to be the sheriff. I don't feel like my work is done here. And quite frankly, the citizens of Colorado, I don't know if there's, you know, we keep using this term woke, but I don't know if the citizens of Colorado have felt enough pain from these Democrat failures to understand cause and effect right now and boot Governor Polis out of office. It's going to take a heck of a hard struggle for someone to run against the governor and have success.
Unfortunately, I think you're right, and which means we're in for a lot more pain. But again, this crime issue, I think, just hits home. I had coffee today with a very liberal friend who lives in Denver, and she's like, I can't call the police enough. I mean, the homeless people just like live on the little space between like her house and the sidewalk, right? They live there. Yeah. She said when she has people come and park, they don't, and by on the street, she goes up if she sees them and says, "Don't park here. Your car will be vandalized by the time you leave." She said they've had to convert their base essentially into their garage because their garage has been broken. And this is a nice neighborhood in Denver. Their garage has been broken into so many times, golf clubs, bikes, everything stolen. She said, we can't keep anything, including our cars, in the garage. And I mean, it's just, and she's very liberal and she's like, I don't know what's happening. I'm like, I can tell you what's happening. It's these policies that for whatever reason, criminals aren't criminals. I mean, we all saw the video of the people robbing the store in San Francisco, just running out. And what San Francisco, now they've got Target stores are closing early because, you know, and the prices go up for the rest of us. I just don't get, what do you think the Democrat, how can a Democratic legislator actually say, oh, this is a good idea to let this keep happening?
You know, I really struggle with that because when I hear these arguments that they make down on the floor of the Senate or, you know, wherever in the legislature, it's not logical to me to hear the champions of the ACLU talk about, well, these are only property crimes, and most of these crimes are motivated by the fact that the person has an underlying addiction or they have a mental health disorder or a combination of both, and we shouldn't punish them for things that they can't control. Okay, well, if that's the case, if we shouldn't deal with the crime that they're committing, then maybe we should figure out how to not have them in that situation. But we fail to address that, too. That came up during red flag debate. states. Oh, well, we'll ban guns, but we don't want to address mental health concerns. And you can't tell me that everyone that's committing crime in Colorado is doing it because they have a mental health problem. Yes, that is an issue in the state of Colorado, but that's not an excuse for every criminal behavior.
No, I mean, for instance, if I want a new car and I now understand that I can steal a car and nothing will happen to me, I could either A, get a job and work hard and save up and take a year to go buy a car, or I could just go steal one. I mean, I don't think I need a mental health, you know, there's something mentally right. healthy about that choice when you get right down to it. When you take, it's like anyone as a kid knows that. If you tell a kid, hey, you know, you can do anything you want, and actually, I don't even really consider that misbehaving anymore. You know, I mean, what is, of course, with human nature being what it is, as we were talking earlier, sort of right. the decay, I think it's going to get way worse before it gets better. What do you think?
Well, you know, we were all together at an event down in downtown Denver where I thought that was the height of how bad things could get, and I was wrong. It's continued to get worse. If you go through downtown Denver right now, they just keep moving the groups around, but lawlessness reigns in downtown Denver. It reigns in many places around the state. And even here in some of our cities and towns in Weld County, we're experiencing that same homeless rush that's coming in, and there's nothing to motivate these people to leave the state or get right with the law, because there's no punishment for their bad deeds. Honestly, I don't see this changing until we start to feel the pain of these Democrat policies that are hurting all of Colorado. But we have to feel that pain on a much bigger scale than just us having this conversation on the phone. The average soccer mom has to say, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't raise a family here. I got to vote differently.
Well, let me ask you this. You're in Weld County, and that's ground zero for changing the Republican Party into a semi-democratic party. Catherine Murdoch plowed in hundreds and hundreds of thousands into Republican primaries to get, quote-unquote, more bipartisan Republicans. And some of those, like Barbara Kirkmeyer, you could say, fit that, although they now get C and D and F scores on the Liberty scorecard. If we thought that was a lot of money, the left is going to pour in millions in the 2022 cycle on primaries to make sure that conservatives can't get elected. Is there any talk about that problem in Weld County?
So, you know, amongst some of us that are in elected positions, we've talked about if certain seats will be targeted. You know, I don't know what that's going to look like. The makeup of the legislature is obviously, it's not very conservative leaning, but the seats that seem to be targeted by those special interest groups, when you look at local elected officials, there's been a big focus on DA's races. There's been a big focus on clerk and recorder races. I don't know how that plays out in Weld County. We have a very strong constituent base here that is mostly conservative, but it is changing. I mean, in the south part of Weld County, you know, we butt up to the Denver metro area, Erie, Thornton, all those areas are starting to kind of invade in, and they don't necessarily have the same political views, or the people that are moving in don't necessarily have the same traditional political views of Weld County. So it's a tough road to predict.
Yeah, but well, the trouble is, you know, money is the mother's milk of politics. And if you're a conservative running for a House seat or a state Senate seat, and you have, let's say you're rich and you can pour in $100,000, and your opponent is one backed by Unite Colorado, can put $1 million in.
Right, yeah.
The chances
right.
of winning are pretty small. They're pretty small. Well, let me finish that.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, I mean, that's as a practicality, the legislature was far more conservative 2 years ago than it is today. And 2 years from now, it'll even be a lot more liberal, and there'll be very few, if any, conservatives left.
Well, as long as big money wins the race, as long as, you know, guys like Jared Polis can spend $23 million to be the governor, you know, the agenda gets pushed based on who has the most money to bring to the table. And that's not the way politics should work, but it is the way politics works. I mean, I spend an inordinate amount of time trying to raise money in a seat that should be pretty, pretty secure for conservatives. But, you know, I'm also, obviously I'm vocal in my opinion, so I know I draw attention from the other side of the equation, and heck, I never know who's gonna throw their hat in the ring, and I want to be prepared for that. But every single seat has to be treated that way, from a conservative viewpoint.
Well, and I think you're right. Unfortunately, things, you know, you're seeing in New York a little bit of a turnaround. I think things are going to have to get much more, and you're, that's exact words, much more painful in Colorado. Like you said, you know, the soccer mom's going to have to, you know, go try to visit a Rockies game in downtown Denver. And yeah, exactly. And get harassed and her purse snatched, and then maybe say, hey, wait a minute.
This is not working too well.
You know, here's the problem, the concern I have too, is I think since the Democrats control things, I don't think they care. I think they're like, so what if a few soccer moms get assaulted and robbed? That's all right. We have our agenda. And for whatever bizarre reason, their agenda is to push this crime and chaos deeper and deeper and more into our communities. That's my big concern.
Well, I often look at it and say, what's the end result? What's the win? And all I can see is if you create enough chaos, then eventually you can come back and introduce what the cure to that chaos is. And it's a different brand of, you know, it's a different solution, if you will. Instead of local law enforcement being the people who keep you safe, then maybe it's a state-run police department or whatever.
Did you see Nancy Pelosi is going to start sending the Capitol Hill police who answer to no one but her to certain pockets of domestic terrorism around the country? So, yeah, you're going to have a bunch of D.C. cops sitting outside.
Under the control of Nancy Pelosi.
Under the control of Nancy Pelosi.
What could sound worse than that?
Hey, Steve, we're going to let you go. Thank you for
your
time.
Thanks so much, Steve. You've been great. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Bye-bye. Yeah, that was three other quick things I want to talk about. One, two to horrify you and one to give you hope. As I just said, the DC police, Nancy Pelosi and Mark Poffice talked about that saying, he says, we're seeing in smaller towns in Colorado, an increasing federalization of the local police departments. He's like, why do these tiny, teeny little towns in rural Colorado need a bunch of DEA agents, right? Well, that don't even, at least the DEA, there's some oversight.
We have the FBI investigating some county clerk for fraud or corruption.
Right, exactly.
And you kind of go, well, why don't you guys go to Washington and find some fraud and corruption? I mean,
they don't have it there. Here's the other thing, too. No, you know, sooner or later, you're going to hear a ding dong. It's going to be the Biden administration knocking on your door to find out why you haven't been vaccinated. That isn't going over very well. But on a positive note, because we only have a couple of minutes left, I think this is great that maybe, you know, Trump today filed, he's like the main litigant in the filed a class action lawsuit against big tech for censorship. And we'll talk about that. Some of the liberal media are saying, oh, they're private companies, so they don't have have to follow the First Amendment. But I think we don't have time today, but we'll talk about it maybe on Friday. They're wrong. I think that there is it's who's deciding, but don't throw that out. Don't say what's going to get thrown out. And I'm just glad to see once again, Donald Trump fighting back for
the only
all
guy
of us.
Santas and a few others, but I don't see it a lot here in Colorado, and I don't see it elsewhere.
I know, Chuck, you just were a downer. Chuck is being a downer there. So, Leo, so don't curl up. Leo,
and
don't.
Aren't evil.
Hey, listen, everybody, thank you for listening today.
Take care. Have a great Wednesday, and we'll see you
on Party Friday. Bye, everybody. Thank you to the guests, and thank you to the listeners, and thank you to Tom and all the great guys at BBS.
Bye-bye.